Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website.
International condemnation and calls for accountability over Israel's violence towards Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque and the desecration of the Muslim holy site. France prepares to choose a new president on Sunday in a showdown between the incumbent Emmanuel Macron and the far-right challenger Marine Le Pen following a bitterly polarizing campaign. And pressures mount on Sri Lanka's prime minister to quit as his own party members back protests demanding his resignation over a worsening economic crisis. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Israel announces the closure of the only crossing with the Gaza Strip, citing rocket launches from the besieged Palestinian territory. The Israeli Ministry of Military Affairs says Gazan merchants and workers would not be allowed through the Erez crossing on Sunday. It says the reopening of the crossing will be decided after the security situation is assessed. Israel says rockets were fired from Gaza on Friday and early Saturday. No casualties or damage were reported. Palestinian officials in Gaza have not commented either. The development comes amid an Israeli crackdown on Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds. Dozens were wounded on Friday.
Israeli military forces have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds as worshippers gathered for dawn prayers, with medics reporting that more than 40 Palestinians were injured as a result of the raid. Local sources said some worshippers were trapped inside the mosque amid clouds of tear gas, with the regime troops throwing stun grenades at them. According to the Palestinian media, at least 43 Palestinians were injured in the raid. The development comes a day after as many as 30 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces continued their violent attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds. The troops used rubber bullets, tear gas canisters, stun grenades, and pepper spray against the worshippers, who have been braving increasing aggression ordered by the Israeli regime since the beginning of the holy fasting month of Ramadan.
Right now, of course, the site of the mosque is sacred to three major religions, but the Israelis have no consideration for anyone but themselves and their own wants and desires. So right now, when they are entering the mosque, the sacred mosque, attacking people while they're praying, worshippers are there for dawn prayers, and the IDF soldiers and the settlers are simply invading the mosque, firing tear gas, rubber bullets, and live rounds of ammunition sometimes, all to terrorize and drive them away. Because they want the site completely for themselves.
The series of raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, one of the holiest sites in Islam, began last Saturday when the Israeli troops injured more than 150 Palestinians there.
Hamas has warned that continued violations at Al-Aqsa could set off another military confrontation with Israel. The resistance movement has called for mass Palestinian mobilization in defense of Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds City. Meanwhile, Iran has condemned the desecration of Al-Aqsa by the Israeli regime, saying that it's witnessing, quote, Zionist crimes on a daily basis.
Israel's new campaign against the Palestinians doesn't stop at the occupied West Bank. On Thursday, the Israeli army carried out airstrikes across the Gaza Strip, targeting positions belonging to the resistance groups. Similar developments last year led to an 11-day war between Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The conflict killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. The Arab League broke its silence on the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa, calling on the regime to prevent Israelis from entering the compound. In an emergency meeting in the Jordanian capital, Amman, the organization warned that Israel's actions threaten to ignite a cycle of violence, and the attacks and violations represent a blatant provocation to the feelings of Muslims. But how will such declarations help diffuse the situation when, ironically, countries that have recently normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Morocco, were in attendance at the meeting? People took to the streets of the Jordanian capital Amman in solidarity with the Palestinians on Friday, calling on the government to expel the Israeli ambassador and scrap a peace treaty signed with the regime. Such protests have been held in several different countries, but without a unified international response to Israel, the protests are unlikely to be enough to put an end to such violations.
The international community, as you mentioned, is not doing anything about this. It's so hypocritical to see the international community condemn the things that the Russians are doing to the Ukrainians when the Israelis are doing the exact same things to the Palestinians, and their crimes are supported by the United States and other nations.
In the absence of any practical measure taken against the regime, resistance seems to be the only option.
Moving on, multiple bomb attacks on Hazara community in Afghanistan have left dozens of families in great sorrow. The relatives of the victims are calling for justice and an end to the violence. Rahmatullah Bhagwan has more from Kabul.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents and some their children. Here, we are meeting the family of Shahid Milad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Milad's mother can't speak, as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Milad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father. After the attack on the school students, Mir Hussein went to bring his son home, but he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
Mahdi has survived the attack, but he is struggling with the shock of the attack and the pain of losing his father. Likewise, in the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds.
These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
After 3 weeks of waiting for the reopening of Sana'a International Airport, the Yemeni Civil Aviation Authority has announced the start of the commercial flights to Sana'a Airport next Sunday. According to the announcement, there will be one flight a week, which is not enough to help the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more on the story from Sana'a.
Yemen Civil Aviation and Meteorology Authority announced that the first commercial flight to Sana'a International Airport will start next Sunday from and to Jordan. Observers say the UN brokered agreement said there will be two flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan, and allowing one flight only is not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Announcing the start of one flight per week to Jordan is not enough and confirms there are no sincere intentions by the Saudi-led coalition to abide by the declared UN truce. There must be a full opening of Sana'a Airport and the port of Hodeidah because the humanitarian situation cannot tolerate more restrictions.
The Ministry of Health says thousands of patients, including children, are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Therefore, the United Nations should fulfill its duty and remove any restrictions on the two weekly flights.
Yemeni patients suffer greatly due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport because they need to travel abroad for treatment. There are 30,000 registered patients in the higher medical committee, including children suffering from congenital anomalies and cancer. We demand the United Nations and the UN envoy open Sana'a's airport permanently and not for one or two flights per week, as it's not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 and imposed a closure on Sana'a International Airport. This closure has led to the death of thousands of patients, including children, especially amid the collapse of the healthcare system in the country due to the years-long Saudi war and the blockade.
Yemenis received the news of resuming the flights of Sana'a International Airport with hopes to see further flights to other destinations around the world. They say opening Sana'a Airport will save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, who are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
After a bitter and divisive election campaign, France is preparing to vote for its president for the next 5 years. A runoff ballot pits centrist President Emmanuel Macron against far-right challenger Marine Le Pen. Opinion polls suggest a re-election for pro-European Macron. He won the first round by nearly 28% of the vote, while anti-immigrant Le Pen came in second with just over 23%. The turnout was down 4% from the last election, with voters somewhat disenchanted by choice of candidates. In 2017, Macron beat Le Pen with over 66% of the vote. Macron seeks to become the first French president to win re-election in two decades. A Le Pen victory would make her modern France's first far-right leader and first female president. She seeks to capitalize on public dissatisfaction with the incumbent's economic policy. Purchasing power is voters' top concern following a huge increase in energy bills or energy prices and rising inflation. Polls will open at 600 GMT on Sunday. Official results will trickle in through the evening. Russia has resumed its assault on the last Ukrainians holed up in the city of Mariupol. Kyiv says Russian forces are pounding the Azovstal complex, a giant steel factory in the southern port city, and are trying to storm it. More than 1,000 civilians are holed up with troops at the Azovstal plant. Clashes come 2 days after Moscow declared victory in Mariupol. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia plans to capture other countries following its attack on Ukraine. He was reacting to comments by a top Russian general. Rustam Minnikhaev said Russia wants to take full control over eastern and southern Ukraine as part of the second phase of a special operation there. Researcher Greg Simmons says the Ukrainian president's suggestion that Russia plans to capture other countries also is just an attempt to provoke them into getting involved in the Russia-Ukraine war.
Ukraine is staring a military defeat in the face. So what this is, it's, as rightly noted, it's a fear-based appeal, not to Ukrainians, but more widely, Europe and anyone else that would listen. Because obviously, the propaganda and the weapon supplies alone are insufficient to halt the Russian advance. So this is an appeal based on fear that something bad can happen in an invasion, and that something bad can happen to them, an invasion to these countries, whoever they may be, because he doesn't name them. And so people are more likely to react emotionally than logically and dismiss this. This is what the attempt is. So he's trying to get a direct involvement of other countries into the Ukrainian conflict. This is the intention of the appeal.
Sri Lankan government loyalists are calling on the Prime Minister to quit, as protest pressure keeps mounting over a worsening economic crisis. The media minister, Nalaka Gurahiwa, and other senior party members demand the resignation of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and his brother Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa. The media minister also called for the resignation of the entire cabinet for an all-inclusive interim government to take over. Gurahiwa says the government lost its credibility after the police killing of a protester on Tuesday. The president has already sacked three cabinet members, but protesters say these cosmetic changes are not enough. The island nation is in the grip of its worst ever economic crisis, with people facing power cuts and shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. The situation has ignited protests, with angry demonstrators camping outside of the presidential office for over 3 weeks. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
Pentagon prosecutors have struggled for more than a decade to hold a trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his accused accomplices in the 9/11 attacks. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Carol Rosenberg and Charlie Savage. The piece is titled September 11 Prosecutors Are in Plea Talks That Could Avert a Death Penalty Trial. Stay with us for more. Prosecutors have opened talks with lawyers for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the accused mastermind of the September 11, 2001 attacks, and his four co-defendants, to negotiate a potential plea agreement that would drop the possibility of execution, according to people with knowledge of the discussions. Guilty pleas in exchange for life sentences could bring to an end the long-running case at the War Court, which was set up by the George W. Bush administration and has been mired in pre-trial proceedings focusing on the CIA torture of the defendants. Nearly a decade after the men were arraigned, the military judge has set no trial start date. No deal is expected soon, but guilty pleas resulting in life sentences could force the Biden administration to modify its ambition of ending detention operations at Guantanamo Bay and instead rebrand it as a military prison for a few men. In an earlier failed attempt at such talks during the Trump administration, the accused plotters demanded that they serve their sentences at Guantanamo Bay, where they are able to pray and eat in groups. They specifically did not want to be sent to the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, where federal inmates are held in solitary confinement up to 23 hours a day. The five men are accused of directing and training or providing travel arrangements and money to the 19 hijackers who crashed four commercial planes into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in Pennsylvania, killing nearly 3,000 people. A plea deal would undoubtedly disappoint, if not enrage, death penalty advocates among the victims' family members. But other 9/11 family members, including those troubled by the role of U.S. torture in the case and the delays, might see it as a fitting conclusion. The path to a trial for the accused September 11, 2001 plotters has been impeded by legal and logistic challenges, as well as a nearly two-year closure of the court during the coronavirus pandemic. The discussions began last week amid the latest setback. The judge, defense, and prosecution teams have traveled to Guantanamo Bay for 3 weeks of hearings meant to address disputes over evidence, particularly showing the role of the FBI in the CIA prison network, where Mr. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his co-defendants were tortured after they were captured in Pakistan in 2002 and 2003. But before they could start, Cherub Borman, the lead lawyer for one of the defendants, Waleed bin Attash, asked to step down from the case. She cited an unspecified in-house investigation of her performance and conduct by the Chief Defense Counsel, Brigadier General Jackie L. Thompson Jr. of the U.S. Army. No details were given, but the issue forced a delay in hearings that could stretch for months and provided an opening, according to a participant in the talks, between the prosecution and the defense. A lead case prosecutor, Clayton G. Trivett Jr., wrote on Wednesday to the defense teams proposing that they discuss whether pretrial agreements are possible for all five cases. "While I cannot guarantee that we will come to terms over these next 2 weeks," Mr. Trivett said in an email, "putting a concerted effort focused solely on possible agreements where we are all on board Guantanamo, where your clients and teams are present, may be our best chance of at least determining if deals can be reached." Within days, the five defendants and their lawyers met in the courtroom to compile an initial list of requirements for the guilty plea, starting with removing the death penalty from the case. Lawyers for the five men submitted a joint list on Monday, participants said. Although the prosecutors have begun the negotiations, a senior Pentagon official, known as the convening authority, must approve any deal. The role is currently held by Colonel Jeffrey Wood of the Arkansas National Guard, who is also a lawyer in Little Rock, Arkansas, and was appointed to the civilian job by the Trump administration. Participants said the talks were expected to continue through the month to try to reach some understandings to present to Colonel Wood. The interim chief prosecutor, Colonel George Kraher of the U.S. Army, declined to comment, as did the Chief Defense Counsel, General Thompson. Both men are new to their jobs. Colonel Kraher was mobilized to the job from the Justice Department in October. General Thompson, who runs the defense office but represents no single defendant, took over on 1st of January. A month later, General Thompson wrote to President Biden to introduce himself, according to a person familiar with the matter. The general described the challenges that the military commission system had experienced in getting cases to trial and proposed a new effort to improve relations between prosecutors and the defense, which were strained and not conducive to plea negotiations. In early March, a lawyer at the National Security Council wrote back to General Thompson that the administration would not be taking a position on any of the cases, according to a senior administration official. The letter specifically did not take a position on plea deals, not endorsing the idea, but not discouraging it either. Instead, the official described the letter as saying that President Biden remained dedicated to responsibly reducing the detainee population at Guantanamo, which currently has 38 prisoners from the roughly 780 who were brought there from 2002 to 2008. 10 are charged but have yet to be tried. The White House has later said reducing the population could include resolving the pending military commissions cases through pre-trial agreements, if appropriate, according to the official. But the letter also stressed that the White House would not prescribe what to do with any particular case or otherwise interfere with the process. Caroline Crass, the general counsel of the Defense Department, was copied on the reply, the National Security Council lawyer said. It is not clear what happened next, but on 4th of March, Colonel Craher met by video conference with the lead lawyers in all current prosecutions and told them his case prosecutors had the authority to begin negotiations. Advocates for closure have suggested that some of the men who face charges could serve their sentences in the custody of another country. Convictions through plea deals might also persuade Congress, which forbids the transfer of detainees to the United States mainland, to lift the restriction for the purpose of incarcerating inmates who have been convicted in secure, more efficient settings. During the Trump administration, the convening authority, Harvey Ryshikov, was exploring the idea of plea agreements. Attorney General at the time, Jeff Sessions, found out about the talks, testimony in court showed, and called Defense Secretary James Mattis, demanding that there be no deals. Defense Secretary James Mattis then fired Mr. Ryshikov, citing unrelated reasons. A core issue is how many of the defendants beside Khaled Sheikh Mohammed would serve life sentences without possibility of parole, and whether some of the accused accomplices with lesser roles in the attacks would serve shorter sentences. Lawyers for two of the defendants, a Saudi prisoner, Mustafa Al-Husawi, and a Pakistani national, Amar Al-Baluchi, who is Mr. Mohammed's nephew, have described them as ignorant of the 11th of September 2001 plot, when they helped some of the hijackers with money transfers and travel arrangements from the United Arab Emirates. Psychologists conducting interrogations for the CIA waterboarded Khaled Sheikh Mohammed 183 times. Defense lawyers have pursued an overarching theory that because of its actions, the U.S. government lost the moral and legal authority to execute the defendants. Agents also kept the five defendants nude, beat them, strung them up by their arms in chains, and subjected them to steep deprivation during the 3 and 4 years they were held in the so-called CIA black sites before their transfer to Guantanamo Bay in 2006. As part of any plea agreement, the defendants would have to work with prosecutors through their lawyers on individual lengthy narratives known as a stipulation of fact, essentially a prosecution-approved admission of their crimes. Once signed, the men could be brought to court for questioning by the trial judge, Colonel Matthew McCall of the U.S. Air Force, on whether they cooperate willingly with the process. Under war court law, military juries, not judges, sentence defendants who plead guilty generally from a range set in the plea agreement. The Pentagon would need to assemble a jury of U.S. officers to hear the statements and other presentations by both sides, and then issue sentences, even if they're separately capped in secret pretrial agreements. That portion could last many months. People familiar with the talk said a military jury's recent reaction to descriptions of CIA torture of another prisoner in a lesser-known case might have contributed to the willingness of prosecutors to negotiate. In October, the jury condemned as a stain on the moral fiber of America the agency's cruel treatment of Majid Khan, a confessed courier for al-Qaeda, and urged the overseer of military commissions to grant clemency.
Africa Today.
The people of Burkina Faso have held rallies calling for the termination of military cooperation with France. Now, the masses are demanding that the new Burkina Faso government establishes military ties with Russia to combat terrorism. Now, here is one such protest in the country's capital, Ouagadougou.
We don't want no more France. Because we need the defense of Russia. France haven't done anything who has given us success.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on growing anti-France sentiments in Burkina Faso, where people believe there is a link between increased terrorist attacks and the presence of French troops in the country. The second segment of our program is on the potential of Africa's groundwater resources in improving the continent's food security.
France faces trouble in Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso, a West African country of 21 million, attracted headlines recently when it joined countries in the region that have witnessed military takeovers. The military coup in January was supported by most civilians who blamed the ousted government for failing to stop terrorist groups.
Burkina Faso has suffered deadly terrorist attacks despite the presence of French troops that are ostensibly in the country to combat terrorism. Now, after the recent coup, a group of over 70 Burkina Faso civil society organizations held a rally to call for the termination of military cooperation with France.
For years, France, our colonizers, has been in Burkina Faso believing that it is fighting to defend our interests, but it is the opposite. France is in Burkina Faso to plunder our wealth and also creating terrorism by supplying arms to the terrorists, and it is these same terrorists who are fighting our soldiers on the front line.
Now, for more on the rising anti-France sentiments in Burkina Faso, we contacted Mustafa Traore, an academic and political analyst who is also the founder of anopeneye.org. Welcome to our program and thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
Now, Mr. Traore, in your opinion, what's the reason behind rising calls by the people of Burkina Faso for end of military ties with France?
Well, I think that in Burkina Faso, the people have just witnessed what happened in Mali, which is a neighbor country, and since the French have decided to leave the country, Mali, it seems that in terms of attacks and management of the territory, there is a progress. So they are inspired by what they saw in Mali, and they would like to have the same thing. One thing it is. Since the arrival of the French in Burkina Faso, it seems that they have the people from Burkina Faso have been the victim of more and more attacks from the terrorists. So there's maybe a correlation. This is what people are thinking right now. Is there a correlation between the presence of the French army in Barkhane in this region of the African continent, and the terrorist attacks.
A rebellion in Mali by marginalized Tuaregs in 2012 has now set the entire Sahel region ablaze. Various terrorist groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh or ISIS are grabbing territories, controlling economic activities, and triggering political instability. Burkina Faso is now an epicenter of terrorism as external players seeking to control the country's gold mines and regional economic trade routes connecting other landlocked Sahel countries to the West African coast. The people in Burkina Faso believe, contrary to claims by France, its troops are not fighting terrorists and that they are actually part of the problem.
France has to leave, together with its weapons. That's it. That's what we want. We don't need the French army.
Mr. Traore, they have talked about the correlation between increased terrorist attacks in Burkina Faso and the presence of foreign forces in the country. Now, Mr. Traore, can you elaborate further on these?
We know that this region of the African continent is very rich in gold. We know that there are lots of resources. We know that the Western world is attracted by this region, and they would like to exploit this region. So if you have the power, or if you make this piece of land yours, the Western countries will have to negotiate with you. So which means that you will benefit from the resources. So I think this is what the terrorists have calculated. This is why there is no attack against the French, against any European army in the region. We have from time to time some attacks against the MINUSMA, but MINUSMA is mostly composed of African troops. So this one tells us a lot about the objectives of the terrorists, the reason why they are not attacking the French from the Balkan.
Decades after it was forced to grant independence to African countries it had colonized, France continued to dominate the former colonies militarily or economically by backing autocratic leaders who served its interests. However, due to rising insecurity and increased poverty, the masses in West Africa blame France for their current predicament. Spontaneous anti-France protests are now common across West Africa. A Malian official speaks here during an anti-France rally in Bamako.
There are thousands and thousands and thousands of Malians today who say no to France. So what the European Union and France needs to do is respect the Malian authorities. They need to understand that the authorities in charge today are the only ones who can speak for our country.
Apart from Burkina Faso, over the past few months, we have seen rising anger against France across West Africa. Should we expect a popular uprising against French imperialism in West Africa?
Well, I think time has changed. Now you have technology. People have access to the internet, which means that myself, I know what is happening in France. I know what is happening in the UK. I know the interest of France. I know that, for example, France, there's no gold mines in France. But in terms of possession of gold, France is the fourth country in the world. So all these, okay, all these things lead us to ask ourselves questions. So because of the internet, now you have people who have the capacity to explain to the people in the village, in the villages, in the African villages, what is happening. So when they do the connection, when they see better what is happening to them. So time has changed. Communication now is mainly through the internet.
A new government is expected to come to power in France at the end of April after the country's second round of the presidential election. Now, Emmanuel Macron has made attempts to reset ties with Africa and is even making inroads in non-French-speaking African countries such as South Africa and Kenya. Now, will France attempt to fight back and regain its dwindling fortunes in West Africa after a new government comes to power in Paris?
We know that the second round of the French presidential elections are going to be between Macron and Marine Le Pen. So Macron has not understood the Malians, and they do not and the Malians and the people from Burkina Faso, all the people from this region. So will France be able to change its mindset to understand them and know and learn how to deal now, today, in the 21st century, with the Africans? I've got a doubt here. So this is the main problem, I think.
In recent months, Russia has managed to establish a foothold in West African countries that were traditionally seen as being dominated by France, especially Mali and the Central African Republic. Many in West Africa believe Russia's success in combating terrorism in Syria can be replicated in the region.
Now, last question to you, Mr. Traore. Why, in your opinion, are the people of West Africa calling for closer military collaboration with Russia?
Because this is something, the reason why they're asking for more for collaboration with Russia is because they see the results the Malian army was able to achieve since their very strong ties with Russia. There's something that in France and in the West we do not communicate enough is the results of the Malian army. The Malian army is getting strength. It is today, I think, the first military power in the region. In the last few months, the Malian army was able, the Malian state was able to buy something like 40 aircrafts. This is something they have never done before. The French had been in the country for like 10 years, no achievement. And since they've changed their partners, the Malians have changed their partners, it seems that in less than 3 months, they've been able to achieve results that the French had never achieved.
Well, there you have it. West African countries are shifting alliances from France and the West in general to Russia in their war on terror, and they are getting results. We'd like to thank our guest, Mustafa Traore, for his insight. And we'll now take a short break. When we come back, we shall be talking about groundwater utilization in Africa. So stay with us.
Groundwater utilization in Africa.
A recent report by the UN Scientific Organization UNESCO notes that groundwater accounts for 99% of all liquid freshwater on Earth. However, this natural resource is often poorly understood and consequently undervalued, mismanaged, and even abused.
Certain regions, such as Saharan Africa and the West Asia, for example, hold substantial quantities of non-renewable groundwater supplies that can be extracted in order to maintain water security. In sub-Saharan Africa, the opportunities offered by the vast aquifers remain largely underexploited. Only 3% of farmland is equipped for irrigation, and only 5% of that area uses groundwater.
During his address on the occasion of the World Water Day 2022, the chair of UN Water and president of the International Fund for Agricultural Development spoke on why this year's theme focused on groundwater.
Dear friends, in 2022, I look forward to working together to look after and optimize the use of groundwater while balancing the need of people and nature. To harness its full potential and use groundwater in the most responsible and sustainable way, it must be thoroughly explored, analyzed, and monitored. For policymakers in the water sector and beyond, groundwater may be out of sight. Now we need to ensure it is not out of mind. We must fully integrate it into our action plans.
Now, for more on groundwater utilization in Africa, we contacted Professor Sylvester Mpandeli, the executive manager at the Water Research Commission in South Africa. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, can you briefly tell us what is the state of water security in Africa?
Okay. Look, the current state of water security in Africa is a concern for us as Africans. And this is based on the fact that, high extreme climatic events and climate change pose serious threats across climate-sensitive sectors. And we have got the responsibility to make sure that, we look at various, water mixes or water options in order for us to address food security issues on the continent.
In sub-Saharan Africa, groundwater doesn't get such attention. Rather, regional water resource management focuses on surface water development. The Nile Basin Initiative and the Zambezi River Authority are two such examples. Governments have not put enough emphasis on groundwater, yet this is where the potential lies, as this geologist explains.
Right now, the most reliable source of water is groundwater. And like you see, drilling is an exercise that takes only a day and you have water, apart from, you know, spending about a month constructing a water dam and then it becomes dry.
Has the potential of groundwater been fully utilized in Africa?
The answer is no. We have not yet fully explored the potential of groundwater. And this is an option that, we need to push very hard as Africans, due to the fact that, we are not getting above normal rainfall. So therefore, we have got the responsibility to make sure that, we supplement our water sources using, groundwater as a source. I can give you an example about the situation in Cape Town here in South Africa, in Western Cape, wherein smallholder farmers are using groundwater to produce high-quality vegetable products, and they are supplementing those products to various, retailers or markets. This is another case studies that we need to look at, and I do believe that, we've got a very good opportunity in order for us to relieve, pressure, especially on the surface water. And we also have got the responsibility to make sure that, we don't deplete our groundwater resources by making sure that, we take care of the aquifer system.
As other parts of Africa battle with poor water quality, the city of Cape Town in South Africa is focusing its attention on three natural aquifers to ensure good quality water for the future. Mayoral Committee Member for Water Sanitation, Councillor Zahid Badruddin, speaks here at the Cape Floods Aquifer Management Scheme.
The city of Cape Town is investing 2.6 billion rand into our Cape Flats aquifer project. Here we are going to be extracting 5 million litres of underground water a day. The Cape Flats aquifer extends all the way from the False Bay to the Alsieskraal River in the north, and here we're hoping to benefit not only our agricultural communities but our residents at large, because we're going to be producing water to potable standards, which means it is safe enough to drink.
Professor, you mentioned about the farmers in Cape Town. Now, how can groundwater kickstart the green recovery and ensure food security in Africa?
Look, we know that, we are getting, below normal rainfall, as compared to the global situation. The most important thing is for us to make sure that, we produce sufficient food with less water. And groundwater could be used as a source. And, for example, in South Africa here, we always champion that. We also need to look at dry land farming. So if we can tap in on the dry land farming and groundwater resources, this it will be an opportunity for us to increase yields and also to increase production. And therefore, we have got the responsibility to address, food security on the continent. And I'm well aware about the fact that majority of our people, especially at household level, they go to the bed with empty stomach. We have got the responsibility to make sure that, we produce not only sufficient food, but also highly nutritional food.
Recently, the World Water Forum is the world's biggest water-related event, was held in Senegal. This year's forum, under the theme Water Security for Peace and Development, was jointly organized by the World Water Council and the government of Senegal, and was the first hosted in sub-Saharan Africa. Speaking during the opening of the conference, Senegalese President Macky Sall reminded the audience that water is a major challenge for the 21st century.
There is every reason to believe that if nothing is done, the situation will only get worse, due in particular to strong demographic pressure, rapid urbanization, and polluting industrial activities. This 9th World Water Forum gives us the opportunity to sound the alarm on the gravity of the situation so that water issues remain at the heart of the international agenda.
How did this forum help Africa tackle its water challenges, especially the sustainable use of groundwater?
Various strategies, plans, and tactics were discussed at the water forum in Senegal. Therefore, plans are in place to make sure that we explore groundwater resources. The most important thing is to understand the fact that water is a finite resource, and if we don't take care of this precious resources, we're gonna be in trouble. Very soon, considering the fact that the rainfall varies from region to region.
The African Union's theme of 2022 focuses on transforming food and agricultural systems. For many years, the images of starving African children have been splashed on major news networks, yet the continent sits on vast water resources.
Oh, this woman in drought-stricken Somalia speaks here of severe water scarcity in the country.
We depended on the livestock because we would eat them and sell them, but that is no more. Our priority now is finding water. Some people are drinking salt water and it's giving them diarrhea. We need fresh water and food, as now we cannot eat or sell the livestock.
Now, Professor, our last question to you. What is the missing link that can lead to the elimination of hunger in Africa?
Look, the missing link is the fact that, we cannot treat water issues from energy or agricultural activities. What we need to do is to drive our activities in an integrated or in a nexus way, which means that we need to look at water, energy, food or agriculture nexus, and also to understand the fact that these three sectors are interlinked. Therefore, we have got the responsibility to make sure that these three sectors are working together, and we are driving knowledge generation or science policy interface amongst those three sectors. We cannot continue with the business as usual, considering the fact that climate change poses a serious threat in our communities or society. And we also have got the responsibility to make sure that we feed our populations.
Well, I'd like to thank Professor Sylvester Mpendeli for his insights on how Africa can sustainably utilize its groundwater resources. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.